The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. This program was originally broadcast live on 93.9 KPDQ. We hope you enjoy the show.
Well, good afternoon and welcome to the Monday edition of the Georgene Rice Show. Glad to have you with us. James Blend is producing, Dave King engineering in Portland, Pedro Bartez, he does it all, producing and engineering in Seattle. Well, today is tax day. It's everyone's favorite day, the day Uncle Sam comes collecting. Of course, the truth is that it may be the federal government's favorite holiday, but for the rest of us, probably not so much. But for those of you who have yet to file your taxes, you have until 11:59 tonight to get them filed. Or you can also apply for an extension. Unless you live in Maine and Massachusetts, where April the 17th is the final filing day. So you might want to drive there really quickly if you're not quite prepared. In any event, as we consider the collection of our dues from the federal government, you might also want to think about the unsustainable debt that we are currently facing. Back in 1981, our national debt reached $1 trillion. And at that time, it was hard to even comprehend such a number. Today, the debt has soared to nearly $35 trillion and counting. Now, take a look at the national debt clock, and you'll see the debt grows beyond the annual salary of most Americans in just seconds. Now, as the saying goes, somebody got to pay for it. And that somebody is breathing, living American taxpayers. It won't be the U.S. government. Uncle Sam is flat broke, but he keeps the Federal Reserve printing press in motion 24/7. Now, let's not forget that we have to borrow that money, which means we have to pay interest. For years, politicians from both parties claimed that as long as we could pay off the interest, we'd be in good shape. But that's easier said than done when the debt is astronomical. The government shells out more money by far on its military and defense than any other country in the world, the Washington Examiner reports. Yet that category of spending is set to be far exceeded by payments on the debt. A decade from now, in 2034, should the Lord tarry, annual interest costs are projected to be a whopping $1.6 trillion. That's a staggering 45% higher than the U.S. is forecast to spend on defense in the same year. At least back in the 1980s, remember the 80s? Some of you do. There was a serious talk about tackling the debt to save our children and their grandchildren from the burden of paying it down. For years, Republicans prided themselves on being fiscal hawks, but that hawk didn't fly for long. Unfortunately, it took the partisanship of one president and one speaker to balance the budget. Well, since then, Republicans and Democrats have thrown up their hands. They've continued to spend like there's no tomorrow, and there may not be. At this rate, there won't be a tomorrow, at least one in which young Americans can hope to live better than their parents, or at least equal to their parents. Well, this debt is like walking down a railroad track, with a train off in the distance, but roaring toward us. We've heard the train coming for decades, though it now seems so far off. But in the future, it'll be decision time. Well, Bloomberg recently ran a million simulations on the U.S. debt. The results, according to Fox News, Bloomberg found 88% of them show borrowing is on an unsustainable path of all the tests that he did. The findings come after a forecast by the Congressional Budget Office that indicates the national debt will grow to an astonishing $54 trillion in the next decade. The result of an aging population, the rising federal health care costs, it's unsustainable. Higher interest rates are also compounding the pain of higher debt. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, inflation, student loans, food stamps, foreign aid, cash for illegal aliens, tens of billions for Ukraine, climate change schemes, and let's not forget the trillions for the COVID-19 crisis. To pay for it, the Federal Reserve just prints more money. Well, this causes inflation, and it gives people the impression the government has money in the coffers when it doesn't have any at all. Essentially, we create monopoly money and place the burden on the backs of the people, future people. When a person or business takes out a loan, their borrowing is limited by their earnings from providing real value for other people. The Heritage Foundation's Richard Stern points out, government borrowing, however, is only limited by how much of the fruits of your labor it will take in the future. Well, Stern adds that that's why governments don't really borrow. Government debt ultimately comes out of your wallet through future taxes or inflation. When governments use this unmatched power, they also crowd out private borrowing. This means families can't get a mortgage and businesses can't expand and provide new job opportunities or investment in innovation. No wonder Fitch Ratings downgraded the U.S. credit rating last year from AAA to AA+. As The Hill reported then, Fitch's warning that the growing debt, now well over $32 trillion, and Congress's inability to manage it in a productive and responsible way pose threats to the country's credit worthiness. Meanwhile, neither Democrats nor Republicans have an interest in tackling the debt. It's all about raising the debt ceiling, borrowing more money, and keeping the printing press moving. Well, there was a time when an upcoming presidential election was a perfect opportunity for one party or the other, typically the GOP, to define itself and embrace fiscal conservatism. But Donald Trump and the Republicans aren't even talking about it. We can only hope that a new wave of common sense comes to Washington, D.C. in 2025. I'm not holding my breath, but I am holding my wallet. We owe it not only to ourselves, but to future generations to take the issue seriously. Happy Tax Day. Well, this is just in. The United States Supreme Court today allowed Idaho to enforce its statewide ban on puberty-blocking drugs, hormone therapy, and sex change surgeries for minors. The court, in a 6-3 decision, ruled that the 2023 law may go into effect, though the state cannot apply it to the two plaintiffs who challenged the legislation. We're talking about the Supreme Court upholding Idaho's ban on puberty blockers, drugs, and sex change surgeries for minors. The court granted Idaho's emergency request after U.S. District Court Judge Lynn Windmill ruled that the state's government could not enforce the law during ongoing litigation and argued that the measure likely violates what she saw as parents' rights to decide the medical treatment of their children and what they received. The Idaho state government has appealed the December ruling to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, but that body has yet to rule on the matter. The Idaho Attorney General Raul Labrador, who previously represented the state's first congressional district and later served as chairman of the Idaho Republican Party, argued that Windmill's preliminary injunction should have focused only on the two plaintiffs and that the district court judge overreached in blocking the law in its entirety before it could take effect. Some of the headlines I pondered earlier today: Israel's response could be imminent. Iran threatens 1,500 missiles. The world holds its breath. The race to avert full-blown conflict, prelude to World War II, could strike be decoy, fragile Mideast alliance repelled onslaught, Saudi acknowledges helping defend Holy Land, Islamic Revolution's strategic shift, IDF troops wounded inside Lebanon. And then there were other headlines. Historic criminal trial begins. The Don faces 34 felony counts. Convicted by Memorial Day, poll numbers dropping. Did he fall asleep in the courtroom? Some of the day's headlines. We'll get into some of those as the program progresses. Well, Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps seized a cargo ship said to be linked to Israel. That's from the Iranian state media reporting on Saturday. The Portuguese-flagged MSC Ares vessel was boarded near the Strait of Hormuz between the United Arab Emirates and Iran and was being transferred to Iran's territorial waters, according to the state news agency, IRNA, over the weekend. The ship is said to be operated by the Zodiac Shipping Company, which IRNA linked to Israeli businessman Eyal Ofer. Zodiac stated the ship is managed and operated by UK-based shipping company MSC. Seizure of the vessel comes amid increasing tension between Iran and Israel. And at the start of the month, the airstrike that Iran attributes to Israel, killing 7 IRGC officials, including top Iranian military commanders at the embassy in Damascus, Syria. Israel hasn't claimed responsibility, but the consequences have followed. More on that when we return. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, Israel and its coalition partners in the Middle East successfully defended against an unprecedented Iranian attack featuring hundreds of drones and missiles soaring into the Israeli airspace. Well, the IDF forces said that Early Sunday morning, Iran launched 170 drones, more than 30 cruise missiles, more than 120 ballistic missiles, and over 99% of them were intercepted. Rear Admiral Daniel Haggari called the defense a very significant strategic success, as only a small fraction of them reached Israel itself. A seven-year-old girl who happened to be Arab suffered severe injuries from the shrapnel that fell directly onto her home. She was rushed to the hospital and underwent emergency surgery. For a head wound, an estimated 31 people in total were treated for stress and minor injuries. The U.S., U.K., France, and Jordan came together with Israel to intercept the onslaught of Iranian drones, according to multiple reports. Explosions could be seen over Jerusalem and other parts of the Jewish state as Israel and its allies defended the Jewish state. Most notably, Israel intercepted Iranian missiles headed toward the Temple Mount, a holy site for Jews, Christians, and Muslims. President Joe Biden said in a statement on Saturday, the U.S. military helped Israel take down nearly all of the drones and missiles launched by Iran. At my direction, to support the defense of Israel, the U.S. military moved aircraft and ballistic missile defense destroyers to the region over the course of the past week. Thanks to these deployments and the extraordinary skill of these service members, we helped Israel take down nearly all of the incoming drones and missiles, end quote. Well, throughout the afternoon and into the evening, the president was being briefed on the situation by top U.S. national security brass. Biden promised G7 nations would meet tomorrow to devise a diplomatic response and engage with counterparts in the region. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu responded defiantly, saying his country is strong and prepared to defend itself from any threat. Our defense systems are deployed and we are prepared for any scenario, both in defense and offense. The state of Israel is strong. The IDF is strong. The public is strong. End quote. We appreciate the U.S. for standing by Israel's side, as well as the support of the U.K., France, and many other countries, he went on to say. I established a clear principle. Whoever hurts us, we will hurt them. We will defend ourselves from any threat, and we will do so calmly and with determination. Close quote. Well, upon the attack, Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, he launched a tirade against Israel on Saturday. He blamed the Jewish state for the recent attacks on an Iranian compound in Damascus, saying the malicious regime has made a wrong move in this case. It should be punished, and it will be punished, he went on to say. I did note some are suggesting that Iran was humiliated by this defeat. General Jack Keane joined America's newsroom on Monday, and he discussed Iran's failed missiles and drone attacks on Israel over the weekend and the huge opportunity for Israel and the United States to leverage that humiliation. Keane said that Iran's proxy forces like Hezbollah and Houthi rebels are likely stunned by Tehran's inability to effectively strike Israel. And this is a quote from Jack Keane. Well, they, Hezbollah, have been stunned, frankly, because they have been urging Iran to get more involved in what they are doing. They wanted more direct assistance from Iran, and they finally got it. But what happened, it was is what was historic, because Iran has never invaded Israel before or fired on them consequentially. But the reason is it was an overwhelming defeat for Iran and a humiliation. Their national leaders certainly humiliated, the IRGC humiliated, and I believe the proxies are completely stunned by the results that Iran was not able to achieve anything other than prove their willingness to attack Israel. And yes, I think there's a huge opportunity here for Israel and the United States going forward to leverage itself. Israel fended off a furious attack on Saturday with the help of powerful allies in the region and around the world. End quote. Again, analyst General Jack Keane. Well, multiple countries came together, as I mentioned, to fend off over 300 attacks, drones and missiles launched at Israel, with the Israeli Defense Forces claiming that 99% were thwarted. At my direction, to support the defense of Israel, the U.S. military moved aircraft and ballistic missiles to the region, the president said. But the U.S. was not the only country. As I mentioned, France, Jordan, and the United Kingdom also played roles in this effort. Meanwhile, while Israel decides its next step in responding to Iran's unprecedented attack over the weekend, the White House welcomed Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed Shiel al-Sudani. His visit took place today in the Oval Office, where he sat down with the president to discuss the U.S. mission in Iraq. Unfortunately, this invitation to Washington only rewards al-Sudani and his Iranian backers, who alienated key partners in the region. House and Senate Republicans are not happy about the visit. In a March 28th letter to the president. Lawmakers called out the administration for inviting al-Sudani, stating that, and I quote, the Iraqi government provides some $3 billion per year to Iran-backed popular mobilization forces militias, including four U.S.-designated terror groups, end quote. Well, since October 7th, these proxies have targeted American troops more than 165 times in retaliation for its support for Israel. One of those attacks tragically killed four U.S. servicemen and injured 40 others on the Jordanian border with Syria in January. With the U.S. presidential election in November, Biden will look to al-Sudani to contain Iranian proxy attacks against the U.S. The problem is that al-Sudani has no control over Iran-backed factions because they don't answer to him. They answer to Iran. Well, 2 days after the January 28th attack in Jordan that killed four U.S. troops, Iran-backed Kataib Hezbollah said that it would suspend its attacks on U.S. bases in order to prevent embarrassment to the Iraqi government. Well, that action was only after a visit to Baghdad by Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps leader Ismail Khani. And while al-Sudani, he treads carefully to not upset his Iranian backers, the Iraqi government is doing everything it can to consolidate power overall of Iraq in Baghdad. Well, over the past year, the federal courts in Iraq have slowly chipped away at Kurdish political control over the autonomous Kurdish region in northern Iraq. Now, in separate rulings, the court reduced the number of parliamentary seats for the Kurds, blocked the Kurdish export of oil via the Iraqi-Turkey pipeline, and in addition, withheld public sector salaries in the north. The Iraqi Kurds are close U.S. partners that host the majority of the 2,500 U.S. troops stationed in Iraq as part of the global coalition to defeat ISIS. And while the administration has made statements of support, Biden didn't meet with the prime minister of the autonomous Kurdish region during his February visit to Washington. The Kurds cooperate with U.S. cooperation has made them a target for Iran and its proxies. In the past year, Erbil has faced a barrage of missiles and drone attacks by Iranian proxies, including a ballistic missile attack in January that killed four civilians and injured six others. The Kurds are not the only target for Baghdad. The Iraqi government has also cracked down on Christian groups. Last July, Iraq's president effectively removed the top Christian leader in Iraq in order to hand over the church's extensive property holdings to an Iranian-backed militia leader, one the U.S. sanctioned in 2019. And while Iran gains ground in Iraq, the Biden administration turned a blind eye because it's desperate to keep the situation calm. Knowing this, al-Sudani was likely to drive a hard bargain in Washington. The three issues on the top of that agenda were expected to be U.S. troop presence, U.S. basing, and U.S. sanctions. So this was a controversial meeting, to put it mildly. In other news, left-wing activists disrupted major transportation hubs across the country to protest U.S. support for Israel following the unprecedented drone and missile attacks from Iran to Israel against the Jewish state. Anti-Israel protesters shut down the Kennedy Expressway outside Chicago's O'Hare International Airport and Highway 101 on San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge, resulting in standstill traffic at both locations. The demonstrators voiced their opposition to U.S. support for Israel's ongoing war effort against Hamas by the terrorist group's mass civilian slaughter and sexual violence on October 7th. Travelers attempted to get to Terminal 1 at O'Hare. They could be seen rushing on foot with their luggage to get around the blockage and make their flights on time. The protest reportedly began at 8 a.m. local time. Traffic resumed a little over an hour later. O'Hare International Airport is one of the largest in the country, and there's still no business as usual while Palestinians suffer at the hands of American-funded bombing by Israel. That's according to the activist group Chicago Disruptors on Instagram. A15 Action, one of the activist organizations coordinating the demonstration, said on X, more than 40 disruptors were arrested after blocking the entrance to O'Hare. But there were other locations around the country as well. In other news, Israel is reportedly set to normalize relations with Indonesia following months of secret talks between the two countries and an economic organization. Israel's news publication, Yonet, reported that the talks, which happened over 3 months, ended with an agreement that Indonesia would establish official relations with Israel in exchange for Israel ending its opposition to Indonesia joining the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has 38 member nations. The process is expected to play out in a process that will take over 2 years, according to reports. The Secretary General Matthias Cormann said in a recent letter to Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz that if Indonesia wanted to join the OECD, that all existing member nations, including Israel, would have to agree to it. According to a translation of the report, Indonesia's acceptance would only happen under the explicit condition that Indonesia maintain diplomatic relations with all members of the organization before the decision was made on whether to accept the country. Quick break. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show. Well, Juan Merchan, the judge overseeing former President Donald Trump's hush money trial, refused the Trump legal team's request that he recuse himself on the grounds that he's biased due to his daughter's work as a Democratic political consultant. Well, the request came as Merchan prosecutors and defense lawyers began the jury selection process at the courthouse in Lower Manhattan. Well, Merchan argued that Trump's team had not presented evidence of his bias, citing an advisory committee report which found no reason to justify his recusal. Well, Trump attacked Merchan on social media Monday morning before arriving at the courthouse. I want my voice back. This crooked judge has gagged me. Unconstitutional. The other side can talk about me, but I am not allowed to. Why didn't they bring this totally discredited lawsuit 7 years ago? Election interference, end quote. Well, the former president continued his tirade outside the courthouse. Merchan also oversaw the civil fraud trial of former president of Trump Organization CFO Alan Weisselberg. Last year, Merchan pushed back against allegations that the case was politically motivated. I will not allow you in any way to bring up a selective prosecution claim or claim this is some sort of novel prosecution, he said at the time, adding that he will have very little patience at trial. Any question that is not a good faith basis. Well, Trump's legal team has a difficult task before him, finding unbiased jurors in the Democratic stronghold that is Manhattan. Today, I think they interviewed nearly 100, and half of them had to recuse themselves, saying they could not give him at least 50 of them could not give him a fair hearing. Meanwhile, the jury selection of the former president's trial centered on hush money payments on Monday, with lawyers for Trump and the state meeting with prospective jurors to decide who will sit to hear the case. Well, the judge is overseeing the case in which the president has been charged with 34 counts. The jury selection procedure is simple. Each potential juror is seated in the jury box and will be asked to answer 42 questions from a questionnaire that reviews the individual's work history. Now, could you be seated on the president's jury? Whether or not you are a Trump supporter, whether or not you totally disagree with him, could you be an impartial juror? Here are some of the questions that they have been and will be asked in the days ahead while they're attempting to seat an unbiased jury. 1A, without telling us your address, in what neighborhood do you live? Excuse me. And then they'll ask some specific questions about where they live. Who is your current employer? What is your educational background? Are you married? If you are married or living with another adult, what does that person do for a living? Again, trying to clarify if there's any conflict of interest. What do you like to do in your spare time? Have you ever served on a jury before? If you did, please tell us how long ago that was and whether it was a criminal, civil, or grand jury. Which of the following print publications, cable or network programs, or online media such as websites, blogs, or social media platforms do you visit, read, or watch? The juror is then asked to check through various mainstream news platforms such as Fox News, The Wall Street Journal, and others. They're also instructed to check through a list of social media platforms, including Facebook, X, TikTok, and others. Do you listen to or watch podcasts? If so, which ones? Do you listen to talk radio? If so, which programs? Have you a relative or a close family member or friend ever been the victim of a crime? If so, please briefly tell us what happened. Have you, a relative or close friend, ever been employed by a law enforcement agency? Have you, a relative or close friend, ever been employed by a federal, state, or local government, including but not limited to the state of New York? Have you, a relative or close friend, ever been employed in the accounting or finance field? Have you, a relative or close family, close friend, ever had any education, training, or work experience in the legal field, including but not limited to practicing criminal or civil law? Have you, a relative or close friend, had any experience or interaction with the criminal justice system, including a police officer or other type of law enforcement? If so, and then they want more details. Have you, a relative or a close friend, ever been accused or convicted of committing a crime? Do you, a relative or a close friend, have a pending criminal case? Do you have any political, moral, intellectual, or religious beliefs or opinions which might prevent you from following the court's instruction on the law or which might slant your approach to this case? Do you have a health condition? Without telling us your name, do you have any medications that would prevent you from being able to concentrate? Court proceedings normally end at 4:30 in the afternoon, though on rare occasions we might work beyond that. Would your schedule permit it? Do you practice a religion that would prevent you from sitting as a juror on any particular weekday or weeknight? Can you give us an assurance that you will be fair and impartial and not base your decision in this case upon a bias or prejudice in favor of or against a person who may appear in this trial on account of that person's race, color, national origin, ancestry, gender, gender identity or expression, religion, religious practice, age, disability, sexual orientation, or political views? Can you promise to guard against allowing stereotypes or attitudes about individuals or about groups of people referred to as an implicit bias influence your decision? Have you, a relative or a close friend, ever worked for any company or organization that is owned or run by Donald Trump or anyone in his family? Have you, a relative or close friend, ever worked or volunteered for a Trump presidential campaign? Are you signed up for, or have you been signed up for, subscribed to, or following any newsletter or email list serve run by on behalf of Donald Trump? Do you currently follow Donald Trump? Have you a relative or close friend who's ever worked or volunteered for any anti-Trump group or organization? And then there's some more specifics from that. Have you ever considered yourself a supporter of or belong to any of the following? The QAnon movement, Proud Boys, Oath Keepers, Three Percenters, Boogaloo Boys, Antifa. Do you have any strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about whether a former president may be criminally charged in a state court? Do you have any feelings of opinions about how Donald Trump is being treated in this case? Can you give us your assurance that you will decide this case solely on the evidence you see and hear in this courtroom and the law as the judge gives it? Do you have any strong opinions or firmly held beliefs about the former president Donald Trump, or the fact that he is a current candidate for the president, that would interfere with your ability to be fair and impartial juror? Have you read or listened to audio of any of the following books or podcasts by Michael Cohen or Mark Pomerantz? If so, please list. Let us know if you want, if you have heard or read what you read has affected your ability to be fair and impartial. The defendants in this case have written a number of books. Have you read or listened to audio of any one or more of those books? Do you have any opinions about the legal limits governing political contributions? Can you promise to set aside anything you may have heard or read about this case and render your verdict based solely on the evidence? Can you give us your absolute assurance that you will refrain from discussing this case with anyone in any manner and from watching, reading, or listening to any accounts of this case during the pending of the trial? Can you assure us that you will follow the judge's instructions on the law, including instruction on the definition of reasonable doubt and presumption of innocence? And the final question, the United States Constitution provides that a defendant has no burden to introduce any evidence or to testify in a criminal case. If Mr. Trump chooses not to testify or to introduce any evidence, can you give us your assurance that you will not hold that against him? And I guess there is one other. Is there any reason, whether it be bias or something else, that would prevent you from being fair and impartial if you are selected as a juror for this case? Trump is the first former president ever to be criminally prosecuted. Half of those interviewed today recused themselves because, well, they couldn't be impartial in judging him. Both legal teams can contest the jurors selected for the case, especially if they believe a potential juror would not be fair or impartial in their judgment. Just this process alone is going to take a significant length of time. Well, tomorrow, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in Fisher versus United States, where a January 6th defendant is appealing the government's use of an evidence destruction law to criminally charge him for entering the U.S. Capitol to exercise his First Amendment rights to assemble, speak, and petition. Well, in December of last year, the High Court granted the petition of Joseph Wayne Fisher, who has been charged with corruptly obstructing an official proceeding, namely the joint session of Congress that was convened on January 6th in 21 to certify the 2020 election. The defendants say they briefly entered the U.S. Capitol after Congress had recessed. Currently, the Justice Department has charged nearly 330 individuals, including the president, under this law for obstruction of Congress. Liberty Counsel filed an amicus brief to the High Court, which argues Section 1512 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, a document shredding prohibition that grew out of the collapse of the Enron Corporation, is being used in an unprecedented manner to criminalize large swaths of constitutionally protected expression and runs roughshod over the First Amendment. The Supreme Court will determine whether or not that is, in fact, the case. Hey, you're listening to The Georgine Rice Show.
You're listening to The Georgine Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Georgine Rice. Chuck Swindoll has said that pastors should never retire, and the 89-year-old won't be stepping away from the pulpit, even as his church welcomes his successor. Well, the Christian report points out that Strone Briar Community Church in Frisco, Texas, announced this week that Swindoll will transition to founding pastor, continuing to preach on Sunday as Jonathan Murphy becomes its senior pastor on the 1st of May. This is a very unique way of expanding, of moving into another chapter, as we often call it here, said Swindoll in a video clip alongside Murphy, a Belfast-born preacher who currently serves as chair of pastoral ministries at Dallas Theological Seminary. With over 60 years in ministry, Swindoll is the oldest megachurch pastor in the country and one of the most influential. He's been vocal about his plans to remain active in ministry until his death. One of my great goals in life is to live long enough to where I am in the pulpit preaching my heart out and I die on the spot. My chin hits the pulpit, boom, and I'm down and out, he said. That was at age 75. What a way to die. In my new role, in his new role, Swindoll remains Stonebriar's regular preacher while Murphy leads day-to-day ministries and fills in to preach when needed, according to the church's announcement. We have the funding, the founding pastor being able to continue to preach as long as the Lord would have, and I can have a season as a senior pastor taking responsibility for the staff and caring for them in the ministry direction of the church at large. Murphy said he's been a guest preacher at Stonebriar and serves on the board for Swindoll's long-running radio ministry, Insight for Living, which, by the way, will continue without change. The two have been preparing for the transition for several years, with Swindoll befriending and mentoring Murphy. The church's elders board began considering him as a senior pastor candidate in 2022 and decided last month to bring him on in that role. Swindoll will remain an elder, and Murphy will also join the elder board at the appropriate time in the future, the church said. Murphy will also become the church's primary preacher. Mega church researcher Warren Bird and William Vanderblomen, the authors of Next, Pastoral Succession That Works, have written that an intentional overlap plan seems to be the strongest model for transition. Today, many long-term pastors experience a period of overlap with their successor as a way to help both the congregation and themselves adjust to the transition. It also allows a safety net if the transition hits unexpected challenges. Bird, the senior vice president of research for the Evangelical Council for Financial Accountability, said that a known leader is often the successor, in this case, someone who's been a guest preacher for nearly from a nearby seminary much esteemed by the congregation. Well, according to Byrd, preaching is often the last duty for an aging pastor to relinquish. He said that Swindoll's setup at Stonebriar is similar to other long-serving megachurch pastors in their 80s, such as the First Baptist Church in Atlanta, where Anthony George was announced at Charles Stanley as his successor years before Stanley stepped down at age 87. Stanley also said he didn't believe in retirement and continued his work at In Touch Ministries. Well, the need for pastors to make plans for their successors has only grown more urgent in the U.S. as clergy age. 1 in 4 senior pastors plan to retire by 2030. Last year, Swindoll suffered a fall, experienced low blood pressure, and underwent an angiogram. He was away from the pulpit in January while recovering from an aortic valve procedure. He turns 90 this fall. And while president of Dallas Theological Seminary, Swindoll helped found Stonebriar Community Church in 1998. He's a Texas native, and he had graduated from DTS and began his pastoral career in the Lone Star State back in the 60s. Stonebriar drew in 1,500 weekly attendees within the first 6 months, and it was dubbed by Christianity Today an instant megachurch. At its 25th anniversary in 2023, the non-denominational evangelical church outside Dallas reported 3,700 members, 300,000 square feet of building space, and an annual budget of $17 million. Swindoll is known for his preaching. He has twice appeared on Baylor University's ranking of the most effective preachers, and in 2010, Lifeway Research Survey of Protestant preachers found he was the country's most influential preacher, not named Billy Graham. Murphy commended Swindoll and his congregation for their love for the word. "We talk about expository preaching, but I love that they're expository listeners," he said. "They come ready to hear from God, not to be entertained," end quote. Oh, that's the kind of church I like. Well, despite Swindoll's remarks that pastors shouldn't retire, he has also said there's nothing wrong with retirement as long as you don't stop living for God. You never retire from the Great Commission. And he will not be retiring in the next few years. Well, in other news, the Biden administration officials successfully pressured fact checkers website Snopes to alter its rating on a fact check it conducted regarding a potential federal ban on gas stoves, according to internal communication. And the an independent review of gender-related medical care for minors and young adults submitted on Wednesday last week to the UK's National Health Service found that previous studies on the topic are of poor quality. And there is very limited evidence on the longer term outcomes. Those are quotes associated with medicalized transition. NHS England commissioned the independent review of gender identity services for children and young people in 2020. The report recommends that children and young people refer to the NHS for gender related services, receive a holistic assessment that includes screening for neurodevelopmental conditions, including autism spectrum disorder and a mental health assessment. In other news, California GOP leaders are calling for more accountability after an audit released earlier this week indicated that the state spent around $24 billion to tackle the homeless crisis over the past 5 years, but did not consistently track whether the huge outlay of public money did anything to actually improve the problem. The state auditor's report found that despite roughly $24 billion, that's with a B, spent on homelessness and housing programs during the 2018 to 23 fiscal year, the problem didn't improve in many cities, according to the state auditor's report. Among other things, the report found that the California Interagency Council on Homelessness, which is responsible for coordinating agencies and allocating resources for the homelessness programs, stopped tracking whether the programs were working in 2021. It also failed to collect and evaluate outcome data for these programs due to the lack of a consistent method, the audit found. Well, the bombshell essay penned by I'm not going to go into that. The White House on Friday announced it is canceling an additional $7.4 billion in debt as part of the Biden administration's most recent attempt at widespread student loan forgiveness ahead of the election. The administration announced the handouts targeted at an estimated 277,000 borrowers across the country, with a national debt topping $34.5 trillion. The president touted his Savings on a Valuable Education, or SAVE, plan, which originated after the Supreme Court struck down his student loan forgiveness plan. The White House announcement comes at the heels of an 18-state suing the president over his student loan plan. Missouri, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Ohio, Oklahoma, and North Dakota joined a growing number of states and filed a complaint against the plan on Tuesday. Missouri Attorney General Andrew Bailey's lawsuit argued that Biden's SAVE plan, announced in February, is illegal and would cost American taxpayers $475 billion. Bailey's lawsuit comes just weeks after Kansas and 10 other states sued the administration over the same plan. Well, former President Donald Trump pulled in millions at a fundraiser at a swanky neighborhood in Atlanta that has for years railed against the Democrat-led city's spiraling crime rate and lack of support for the police, even working to secede from the city altogether over the policies. Our digital online fundraising continues to skyrocket. Our major donor investments are climbing, and Democrats are running scared of the fundraising prowess of Donald Trump. We are not only raising the necessary funds, but we are developing strategic assets that will help send President Trump back to the White House and carry Republicans over the finish line, end quote. That's a quote from Trump's campaign communications director, Stephen Chuang, at a fundraising regarding the fundraising efforts last week. Well, Trump attended a fundraiser Wednesday afternoon in Buckhead, a wealthy commercial and residential district there, where local leaders joined the 45th president, including former Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue, as well as the co-founder of Home Depot, Bernie Marcus, and poultry industry tycoon Tommy Bagwell. Trump pulled in more than $15 million on Wednesday from both the Buckhead event and another fundraiser in Orlando, the campaign official said. Guests in Buckhead spent $6,600 per couple and as much as $250,000 if they wish to be part of the event's welcoming committee. President Biden falsely claimed earlier this week that he was the first person in his family to go to college, continuing a decades-long habit of making false or embellished claims about his life. He has been scrutinized several times over the years for fabricating tales, including a claim that he was arrested in apartheid-era South Africa, was in a helicopter forced down by al-Qaeda insurgents in Afghanistan, and even trivial events involving an Amtrak conductor who died before Biden's alleged story took place. He continued the trend on Monday while speaking in the battleground state of Wisconsin as he fulfilled his plan to provide life-changing relief for student loan aid. I, like an awful lot of people in this audience, was the first in my family to go to college, he told the crowd. However, less than 2 years ago, during a speech in Pennsylvania, he told an audience of his grandfather played college football. When asked about Biden's recent comments and his embellishments throughout the year, the White House deputy press secretary said the president is proud to have restored honesty, integrity, and respect for the rule of law to the Oval Office. Well, that's right. This all happened right before I turned down a Pulitzer Prize and accepted my first Heisman Trophy. All right, we've got news coming up at the top of the hour. Stick around. There's more to come.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the second hour of the Georgene Rice Show. Well, the National Science Foundation, the government agency that's tasked with promoting scientific progress, will allocate over $1 million taxpayer dollars to diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts to study Latina resistance and intra-minority solidarity. Well, the NSF, which controls $9.9 billion in federal money and exists to promote the progress of science, advance the national health, and secure the national defense, pledged $498,271 of those dollars to a three-year study at Loyola University, Maryland, focused on Latinas' resistance behavior in engineering programs at predominantly white institutions as part of its broader diversity, equity, and inclusion agenda. It granted another $618,465 to support a study at the University of Washington centered around promoting intra-minority solidarity, particularly looking into how different framings of racial influence Asian Americans intra-minority solidarity with Black Americans, end quote. Well, an agency spokesman defended the study, saying the projects are both worthy of support. Your tax dollars at work. Late last month, the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed in Baltimore, as you know. Six people losing their lives. Given that Francis Scott Key wrote the text of our national anthem, but also owned slaves, some rushed to highlight his faults. Not only after that, we're already hearing about demands for a name change there as well. Mike Collins, who says, who could have seen this coming? They suggested that it be renamed after Representative Perrin Mitchell, the first black Marylander to be elected to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1970. Well, this should not happen, said critics. Let them honor the African-American from Maryland elected to the U.S. House of Representatives another way, a statue in his hometown, an easily accessed memorial marker. He died in 2007. A post office or some other way is sufficient. There's no reason to change the name of a 47-year-old bridge, again, according to critics. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre kicked off Thursday's briefing by bragging about the Biden administration's supposedly noble effort to reduce gun violence in the United States and touting a new rule to save lives by requiring background checks. If you listen, the mainstream media talk about the new ATF rule. It's a move by Team Biden to close the so-called gun show loophole. But such a thing doesn't exist in standard fare. The White House, from the White House, the rule is actually about more power for the federal government and greater harassment for law-abiding firearm owners. And the vast majority of firearm owners are law-abiding. Iran on Saturday night launched a large wave of around 300 attack drones and missiles from its territory toward the Jewish state and the first ever direct attack on Israel by the Islamic Republic, triggering air raid sirens throughout the country early Sunday as the military worked to intercept the Iranian projectiles. IDF spokesman Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari, he first confirmed at 11 p.m. that the attack, anticipated for several days, had begun. He later said Iran also fired missiles at Israel while numerous fighter jets were in the sky countering Tehran's attacks. No one drone or cruise missile managed to enter Israeli airspace. Reporter Emmanuel Fabian weighs in, saying surreal footage of the Iranian attack over Jerusalem's Temple Mount was stunning, and the Israeli Defense Forces said on Saturday night that it had intercepted 99% of the drones and missiles fired at Israel by the Islamic Republic of Iran. IDF spokesman Rear Admiral. Anyway, David Hagari, he cautioned that the attack was not over, as U.S. officials warned that Iran had launched an additional 70 missiles after the initial wave was largely unsuccessful. The United States is urging Israel not to retaliate against Iran after the terror-backed country launched dozens of drones on Saturday. The president made it clear the U.S. would not join any Israeli offenses against Iran, which seems patently absurd given what happened. When Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer voiced support for Israel amid a drone and missile attack from Iran this weekend, his GOP colleagues quickly pointed out how the Democrat-led upper chamber had rejected legislation that would provide aid to the U.S. ally. Schumer says, as Israel is under attack from Iran, we stand with Israel and its people, and the United States will do everything we can to support Israel's defense against Iran. Dr. Roger Marshall said, we brought aid for Israel to the Senate floor four times since the unprovoked brutal attacks of October 7th. Chuck Schumer and Senate Democrats blocked our efforts every single time. And Tim Young also weighing in. Chuck Schumer literally called for a new election to dump Israel's current government a few weeks ago. Now he claims to stand with them, end quote. Iranian special forces seized a container ship near the Strait of Hormuz, a key shipping lane to the Persian Gulf. Navy special forces from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, they used a helicopter to board and seize the container ship. The move came, could escalate, rather, tensions in that region reeling from the war in Gaza and a recent strike suspected to have been carried out by Israel. Now, Iran having retaliated, but not injuring Israel. It killed senior Iranian military officials, and that's why Iran was in the retaliatory mood. Israeli Foreign Minister Israel Katz directly responded to the vessel seizure, saying that Iran is conducting piracy and should be sanctioned for it. Meanwhile, U.S. National Security Council Coordinator for Strategic Communications John Kirby repeatedly defended the president's decision to relax sanctions enforcement against the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has helped the country earn tens of billions of dollars in oil revenue. Kirby made the remarks during a Sunday interview with Shannon Bream of Fox News after Iran launched the 185 one-way suicide drones, 110 surface-to-surface missiles, and 36 cruise missiles at Israel. John Kirby insists the billions of dollars Biden has unlocked for Iran aren't going to the regime, denies the funds are fungible, and blames President Trump, who's been out of office now for 3 years. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, who signed on Biden's decision to unfreeze billions in Iran, said Iran has always used and focused its funds on supporting terror. I guess that's supposed to be consoling. Video from a girls' varsity track meet further cemented the resolve of Save Women's Sports Movement as athletes were encouraged to stand down to stand up against gender nonsense. Well, Saturday, as girls competing at a varsity level in the 200-meter race lined up for the heat at Sherwood Need for Speed Classic, a boy met them at the blocks who would go on to set a personal record as he left them all in the dust. He was a boy. A trans-identified male just dominated the girls' 200-meter varsity at the Sherwood Need for Speed Classic in Sherwood, Oregon. Aiden Gallagher, a boy who identifies as a girl, set a new record after easily defeating his female competitors, and the subject blew up on social media. Kansas Democratic Governor Laura Kelly on Friday vetoed legislation that would have banned certain gender-related treatments for minors. The substitute bill for Senate Bill 233 would have banned gender surgeries and hormone treatments for minors and established a civil means for action against health care providers who perform them. Kelly vetoed the legislation, stating, and I quote, "It targets a small group of Kansans by placing government mandates on them and dictating to parents how to best raise and care for their child. I do not believe that is a conservative value, and it's certainly not a Kansas value," end quote. Nearly half of the states in the U.S. have banned transgender surgeries for minors, while 14 have implemented shield laws that protect access to the procedure. A Wisconsin man was sentenced on Wednesday to 7.5 years in prison for pleading guilty to firebombing the office of an anti-abortion, a pro-life group, 2 years ago. Hirindu Roy Chowdhury, 29, of Madison, also will serve 3 years on unsupervised release under the sentence handed down by U.S. District Judge William Conley and was ordered to pay nearly $32,000 in restitution. Six pro-lifers, by the way, face over 10 years in prison over a peaceful protest at a Tennessee abortion facility after they were found guilty of a conspiracy against rights in February. They were being sentenced in July. Quite an interesting contrast. By the way, they didn't block the entrance. They stood nearby praying. President Joe Biden's administration is extending temporary amnesty to more than 15,000 Ethiopian nationals living in the U.S., giving them free access to secure work permits and hold American jobs. The Department of Homeland Security announced on Friday that it is redesignating and extending a temporary amnesty program to thousands of Ethiopians residing in the U.S. illegally who would otherwise face deportation. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said the temporary protected status provides individuals already present in the U.S. with protection from removal when conditions in their home country prevent their safe return. DHS cited several concerning conditions there currently facing those in this country, such as droughts, floods, armed conflict, and disease outbreaks, as a way to justify allowing the immigrants to stay in the U.S. The Biden official also announced that there will be a special student relief for the tens of thousands of Ethiopians living in the U.S. under F-1 student visas. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Back in a moment.
You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to The Georgene Rice Show. Well, the Supreme Court is going to consider shortening the sentence of January 9 protesters. In the aftermath of the event in 21, federal prosecutors had to decide what charges to bring against hundreds of participants in the pro-Trump rally, mob, whatever you want to call it, that disrupted the certification of the presidential election. In more than 350 cases, they included a federal charge that carries a hefty 20-year maximum penalty. Well, as of this month, more than 100 said individuals have been convicted and sentenced under that statute for obstructing or impeding an official proceeding. On Tuesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments about whether prosecutors improperly stretched the law by charging people with that violation in the first place. The High Court's ruling, likely to land in late June, has the potential to undo the convictions and sentences of those who've already gone to trial or pled guilty and upend the charges still pending for many others. About 300 anti-war protesters, activists, crowded into the basement of the Teamsters Union's headquarters on Saturday to hear organizers from all over the country describe their plans to disrupt the Democratic National Convention this August. Joe Biden's backing of Israel since Hamas's October 7th attack has turned these radicals against their own party. But then a man stumbles to the podium, wiping sweat from his forehead, grabs the microphone to announce that the Islamic regime of Iran has launched missiles and drones heading straight toward Israel. Either that day, before the news of the attack broke, at the breakout session on the anti-war movement, and there was cheering. Shabir Rizva is an organizer for the Anti-War Committee Chicago, taught participants how to chant "Death to Israel" and "Death to America" in Farsi. Libs of TikTok, the left said that left-wing activists learned to chant "Death to America" and "Death to Israel" in Farsi at the convention. The enemy is already here, end quote. FBI Director Wray implored Congress to pass a key FISA section. That was on Friday. The grievance with the FBI are by now well documented, but that doesn't mean we don't always have some common ground, especially when it comes to counterterrorism. A case in point came on Friday, or Thursday rather, when the Bureau's director and congressional individual Christopher Wray went to Capitol Hill to lobby for the reauthorization of Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act before it expires this week. Section 702, Wray told the House Appropriations Committee, is indispensable and keeping Americans safe from a whole barrage of fast-moving foreign threats. If only Ray's former colleagues at the Bureau, James Comey, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, and Kevin Kleinsmith among them, hadn't weaponized the FISA statute against one individual by falsifying evidence to secure a spy warrant, perhaps Ray wouldn't have struggled so mightily to get Section 702 reauthorized. Well, energy prices have soared under the current administration. The green agenda is costing Americans big time. The price of electricity has soared since he took office, though it can't be blamed on high inflation alone. While the average price of electricity since January of 2021 has risen 29.4%, which is 13 times higher than over the previous 7 years, when the cost of electricity rose just 5%, most of the blame has to do with Biden picking energy winners and losers. At the same time, he's pursued an anti-fossil fuel agenda. $369 billion from the Inflation Reduction Act, which does not accomplish that end, has been funneled to renewable energy companies. As Power the Future Executive Director Daniel Turner observes, in that law, the president and his supporters celebrated the passage of the largest green energy slush fund in history, and all it's delivered are higher prices around the board. End quote. Well, this news comes on the heels of March's CPI, showing inflation rising again. Meanwhile, the administration has been caught once again seeking to dictate news coverage of its fossil fuel actions. The White House leaned on the left media fact-checking site Snopes after it gave a mixture rating to the claim that Biden administration was seeking to ban gas stoves. After being contacted by the White House, Snopes changed its rating to false, adding the statement that the Consumer Product Safety Commission was not currently considering a ban on gas stoves. Well, Snopes made this change despite the fact that CPSC member Richard Trumka Jr. had called for regulating gas stoves, including banning gas stoves entirely, because of climate change. Well, following the disastrous retreat from Afghanistan, the more we learn that not only did this administration fail to prevent the massacre, but it also failed to bring our people home. As the UK's Daily Mail reports, hours of private testimony by two of the top State Department officials who oversaw the evacuation from Afghanistan lays bare the confusion at the heart of the operation and how they failed to respond to warning signs that the Taliban was sweeping across the country. The result was a chaotic operation at Kabul's airport in August of 21, with Americans scrambling to get on flights after the extremist group had seized control of the country. But that wasn't the worst of it. As the two State Department staffers, Brian McKeon and Derek Chaloit, tell it, and I'm quoting, they were still working on a plan to evacuate Americans and their Afghan allies when the bloodthirsty Taliban overtook Kabul. As a result, the Daily Mail continues, hundreds of Americans were left behind and thousands of Afghan allies who worked for the U.S. could not get on to the evacuation flights. So much for the promise to do everything we can to provide safe evacuation for Americans, our Afghan allies, partners, and Afghans who might be targeted because of their association with the United States. Empty words have consequences. Longtime, well-respected, and recently fired, journalist Catherine Herridge has charged CBS News, her most recent employer, with journalistic rape after it seized her reporting files when firing her. "I was locked out of my emails. I was locked out of my office," she told Congress. CBS News seized hundreds of pages of my reporting files, including confidential sources information. Herridge made her comments during a House Judiciary Committee hearing regarding concerns about eroding First Amendment protections for journalists maintaining their confidential sources. "If confidential sources are not protected," she warned, "I feel investigative journalism is dead. Each day I feel the weight of this responsibility." CBS News issued a letter denying that it seized any of her files, claiming that at her termination, human resources entered the office to retrieve Herridge's belongings, but at no time did anyone review any of the files or other materials. David Hogg got schooled on gun control. The anti-Second Amendment activist was recently at Dartmouth University in New Hampshire, where he was rhetorically taken to the woodshed by a Chinese immigrant. Republican congressional candidate Lily Tang Williams confronted Hogg during a question and answer session, noting that she was a Chinese immigrant who survived communism. After relaying how under Mao's communist dictatorship, some 60 million Chinese died and were murdered, she asked Hogg, "Could you guarantee me, a gun owner, tonight our government in the U.S. in D.C. will never, never become a tyrannical government?" Hogg, to his credit, admitted, "There's no way I can ever guarantee that any government will not be tyrannical," Williams aptly concluded. "Well, then the debate on gun control is over, because I will never give up my guns. Never, never. And you should go to China to see how gun control works for the dictatorship of the CCP," end quote. Well, 2/3 of colleges mandate DEI courses. The drop in grads continues. Our nation may well be waking up to this radical view. The FBI is concerned about a coordinated terror attack in the U.S., similar to the Moscow concert hall attack. President Trump says he wouldn't sign a national abortion ban. Former Vice President Mike Pence will teach a course at Grove City College. Wholesale inflation rose 2.1% in March, the sharpest increase in 11 months. And Denver plans to defund its police force to pay for illegal immigrants. Harvard is planning to reinstate the testing requirement for admission. Instagram will blur nude images sent to teens to curb sextortion. And from Apple to LinkedIn, these companies contribute to sexual exploitation. The National Center on Sexual Exploitation has released its annual list of mainstream contributors to sexual exploitation, ranging from big tech giants to pieces of federal legislation. NCOSE announced the 2024 Dirty Dozen list on Wednesday, which includes entities that the group says fail to undertake adequate efforts to better safeguard society from the harms of sexual exploitation. The list names 12 mainstream institutions that facilitate, normalize, and often benefit from sexual exploitation through many forms of exploitation. On another day, we'll go through that list. There are 12. A dance team was forced from a Seattle show because their uniforms were offensive. They depicted the American flag. And Idaho's governor signed bills defining man and woman and barring pronoun requirements. Hamas suggested that there aren't enough living hostages to make a ceasefire deal. And the world's largest Muslim country has agreed to normalize relations with Israel. Israel is reportedly set to normalize relations with Indonesia following months of secret talks between the two countries and an economic organization. Israeli news publication Ynet reported that the talks, which happened over 3 months, ended with an agreement that Indonesia would establish official relations with Israel in exchange for Israel ending its opposition to Indonesia joining the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, which has 38 member nations. The process is expected to play out in a process that will take over 2 years. And for a bit of humor, President Trump has been indicted for taking more Chick-fil-A sauces than he actually needed for his order. We're going to take a quick break. If you're listening in Seattle, we're out of time. I hope you'll join us here again tomorrow. In Portland, there's more to come, so please stay with us.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the Portland-only segments of the Georgene Rice Show. Well, Judge Juan Merchan is deeply conflicted, but he's got a conviction to secure. So the New York City trial of Donald Trump began as scheduled today for his nondisclosure agreement with a actress, Stormy Daniels, with whom he apparently had a brief encounter. Well, never mind the well-documented fact that this hush money case is only being brought because the defendant is Donald Trump and despite Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg having initially declined to prosecute the case. These people, the partisans, who hate Donald Trump and nothing else matters, are moving forward. Never mind the fact that the jury in this case will be selected from a Manhattan pool whose votes went 10% for Trump in 2016, then a whopping 12% in 2020. The jury will no doubt be every bit as fair and impartial as the one that awarded E. Jean Carroll a mind-boggling $83 million for a decades-old department store encounter of deeply dubious credibility. And never mind the fact that two major clients of the daughter of Judge Merchan have raised at least $93 million in campaign donations by using the Trump case in their solicitation emails. And by the way, the judge declined to recuse himself from the case. Surely this judge will be an impartial decider, an objective gatekeeper of evidence and objections in the fate of Donald Trump. And finally, never mind the fact that the star witness in this week on the merits case, Michael Cohen, is a convicted felon and inveterate liar. Never mind all those things. This is an assault, Donald Trump said just before entering the judge's courtroom this morning. It was determined that he would not be free to attend his son's graduation ceremony, nor the Supreme Court case involving his future. Well, of course, today is tax day. It's everyone's favorite. The day Uncle Sam comes collecting. And of course, the truth is, it may be the federal government's favorite day, but few others. For those who have yet to file their taxes, they have until 11:59 p.m. tonight to get them filed, unless they live in Maine or Massachusetts, where April 17th is the final filing day. Meanwhile, the president has been touting a new, free, secure, simple way to file your taxes. It's the IRS's independent filing system, a product of the Inflation Reduction Act, dubbed the Direct File. The IRS test pilot program went live in March with some 19 million taxpayers in 12 states. However, Direct Files was only able to accept roughly 60,000 returns. The reason is that the IRS failed to include users' ability to provide important details to validate their returns until last week. The fact of the matter is that there are already a number of free tax preparation and filing programs out there that have been providing this service for as many as 20 years. So why the IRS is motivated to come up with their own filing system that, as the former President Obama's chief information officer, Tony Scott, predicted was virtually guaranteed to fail? Well, the answer is greater government access to Americans' financial information. Bit cynical? Well, perhaps. Meanwhile, 13 Republican attorneys general, they're challenging the legality of Direct File, and they've sent a letter to Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen calling for it to be shut down. Well, the FBI seems to have launched a criminal investigation into the Singapore flagged ship, the Dolly, that caused the catastrophic collapse of Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge last month. After FBI agents were seen on board the ship early this morning, the agency released the following statement, and I quote, "The FBI is present aboard the cargo ship Dolly conducting court authorization law enforcement activity. U.S. Attorney for Maryland Eric Barron refused to confirm whether or not criminal investigation is being conducted. At issue is whether or not the crew of the Dolly left the port knowing that the ship was suffering serious system problems. This investigation is separate from the one being conducted by the National Transportation Safety Board, which is seeking to determine the cause of the crash. Meanwhile, the Oregon Health Authority's 26th annual report about the Oregon Death with Dignity Act shows an almost 30% increase in the number of prescriptions written for lethal doses of medication under the act in 2023. Prescriptions rose about 29% from 433 in 2022, 560 in 2023. Deaths from ingesting the DWDA medications increased by about 20% from 304 in 2022 to 367 of our neighbors in 2023. The increase in the prescriptions and deaths was driven in part by an amendment to the DWDA passed in 2023 that removed the state residency requirement. The law no longer requires patients to be Oregon residents. All other criteria for participation remains. OHA collects residential data from the death records, but does not receive records from other states unless the decedent was an Oregon resident. This means if an Oregon DWDA patient dies out of state and was not a resident of Oregon, they will unlikely obtain the notice of death. Meanwhile, dozens of people were arrested Monday morning when a group of protesters temporarily blocked all southbound lanes of Interstate 5 between Eugene and Springfield. Photos show people were locking arms in a line across the interstate, some holding Palestinian flags, and law enforcement personnel were at the scene. The demonstration was about a mile north of the intersection of Beltline Highway. Oregon State Police said troopers arrested dozens of people for disorderly conduct after they failed to obey orders to disperse. At least one person was discovered to be in possession of a firearm. Other news outlets around the country have also reported protesters blocking traffic on freeways in Oakland, California, Chicago, and elsewhere. The southbound lanes reopened around 12:15 p.m. Oregon State Police said troopers would remain at the scene for the time being, noting that observers were still gathering around the freeway. Oregon State Police said traffic was blocked for about 45 minutes in total. And as I mentioned briefly earlier in the program, an Oregon high school came under fire on Saturday as a transgender athlete was able to compete against girls at a track meet. Aiden Gallagher, a 10th grader from McDaniel High School, competed in the Sherwood Need for Speed Classic in Sherwood, Oregon. Gallagher was seen in one clip blowing away the competition in a heat for the 200 meter. Gallagher clocked in with a 25.49 mark and ended up finishing in second place in that event, as well as the 400 meter and seventh place in the 4x110, which requires three other participants, the relay, eighth place in the 4x400, again requiring three others. But Gallagher's ability to compete in the event sparked outrage on social media. Championing boys and girls sports is blatant misogyny, the Independent Council on Women's Sports wrote on X. Abuse of girls by the government, Judicial Watch's Tom Fitton wrote. Another proud moment for women's sports, OutKick founder Clay Travis wrote. Libs of TikTok added, these high school girls just had their dreams stolen from them because the school is catering to delusions of a boy who pretends to be a girl. He's a cheater, end quote. Well, the Oregon School Activities Association, or OSAA, has a policy for transgender participation in high school sports. The OSAA endeavors to allow students to participate for the athletic or activity program of their consistently asserted gender identity while providing a fair and safe environment for all students, despite the fact that it does deprive girls of competing against those who are biologically their equal. Well, as with Rule 8.2 regarding duration and of eligibility, graduation, rules such as this promote harmony and fair competition among members of schools by maintaining equality of eligibility and increase the number of students who will have the opportunity to participate in interscholastic activities, end quote. Well, additionally, the OSAA rules state that once transgender student has notified the student's school of their gender identity, the student shall be consistently treated as that gender for purposes of eligibility for athletics and activities, provided that if the student has tried out or participated in an activity, the student may not participate during the same season on the team of the other gender. I used to run in high school, and this would certainly not have been a level playing field. Well, in the wake of an NBC News report revealing that an Afghan migrant on the terrorist watch list spent nearly a year here in the U.S. after he'd caught and released by Border Patrol agents last year. The man was arrested in February and then released last month again by an immigration judge who was not told he was a national security threat. That's according to an NBC report that adds that he's a member of the Hezbollah Islami, a U.S. designated terror group responsible for the deaths of at least nine American soldiers and civilians in Afghanistan. One can only imagine how many other such characters are among the 9 million or so who have made their way into the U.S. via Joe Biden's open borders policies. This is an impeachable offense if ever there was one, and it's to the credit of House Republicans that they failed to bring such to bring such a case before that august body. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment to wrap things up.
You're listening to the Georgene Rice Show podcast. It's aired on 93.9 KPDQ.
Hey, welcome back. You're listening to the final segment of the Georgene Rice Show. Well, the summer months bring with them greater opportunities for travel, and supply and demand being what they are, a greater likelihood of higher gas prices. And Joe Biden didn't help the outlook any on Friday when he issued a host of new regulations designed to make drilling for oil on public lands more expensive. As the Washington Free Beacon reported, the new rules follow years of criticism from green and taxpayer groups of federal oil and gas development. Many of the changes formalize provisions in the president's landmark climate change law, the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act, misnamed. Under the new policy, oil and gas companies will pay higher bond rates to cover the cost of plugging abandoned oil and gas wells, as well as increased lease rents, minimum auction bids, and royalty rates that for the fuels they extract. The rules also limit drilling in sensitive wildlife and cultural areas. It'll be interesting to see what kind of effect this decision has on the mood of the electorate, especially as we move closer to the November election, if people are paying attention. Perhaps by then, the president and the administration will undo the regulations to make it appear the fuel that he feels the American people's pain. Meanwhile, NPR's new CEO is, well, a little upset. She's been on the job for 3 weeks, but that didn't stop National Public Radio's new CEO, Catherine Marr, from blasting 25-year NPR veteran Yuri Berliner's assessment of the left media outlet as deeply simplistic and profoundly disrespectful, hurtful, and demeaning. Berliner, NPR's senior editor, had just published an article exposing the blatant bias of taxpayer-funded NPR. Underpinning Berliner's charges was that his statement that he found 87 registered Democrats working in editorial positions and zero Republicans, none, end quote. In an apparent effort to run damage control, Marr responded, "It is deeply simplistic to assert that the diversity of America can be reduced to any particular set of beliefs, and faulty reasoning to infer that identity is determinative of one's thoughts or political leanings," end quote. At NPR, diversity means having the same political ideology, but with different shades of skin color. Then, after noting the NPR employee's professionalism, she obtrusively added, "We fulfill our mission best when we look and sound like the country we serve." So that's an acceptable diversity. Diversity of opinion, not so much. Following Marr's excoriation of Berliner for daring to tell the truth, some of her past social media posts came to light, displaying her own hard left bias. For example, during the summer of violence following the death of George Floyd, Marr became critical of CNN's coverage of the rioting associated with BLM protests, posting, "I mean, sure, looting is counterproductive, but it's hard to be mad about protesters not prioritizing the private property of a system of oppression founded on treating people's ancestors as private property," end quote. In several other posts, from pushing climate alarmism to masking mandates, Marr shows herself to be ideologically committed to the hard left. In short, Marr is about as open to a diversity of views as a cockroach is to light. Well, the Dems have a seemingly unquenchable thirst for the two-tiered justice, and nowhere is it more apparent than in the struggle for life against the catechism of abortion on demand. Well, the latest example of this comes in the case of Harindu Sankar Roy Chowdhury, a pro-abortion terrorist who firebombed a pro-life facility in Wisconsin on Mother's Day 2022, and who got a mere 7.5 years in prison, minus time served. Compare this individual's unquestionably deadly violence to that of six peaceful pro-life activists who in January were convicted of violating the Federal Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act for ostensibly blocking the entrance to a Tennessee abortion facility in 2021. And how did they block access to this murderous abortion mill? Why, with hymns and prayer, not with physical obstruction. As the Federalist pointed out, the FACE Act, signed into law by President Bill Clinton, punishes violent, threatening, damaging, and obstructive conduct intended to injure, intimidate, or interfere with the right to seek, obtain, or provide abortions. Talk about a grotesque abuse of the spirit of the law. Meanwhile, last Friday, Kansas Democrat Governor Laura Kelly vetoed a bill banning gender-bending medical interventions such as puberty blockers, hormones, and gender mutilation surgeries on minors. Bill 233 was passed by Kansas Republican-led legislature to protect children from becoming victims of the toxic gender ideology of transgenderism plaguing the nation while minors. Following Kelly's veto, the Kansas Speaker Dan Hawkins said House Republicans stand ready to override the veto to protect vulnerable Kansas kids. For the Republicans to successfully override the governor's veto, the House will need to get two more Republicans to vote in favor, and the Senate GOP cannot lose a single vote. Kelly claimed she vetoed the bill because it tramples parental rights. That is a dubious claim, given the fact that they have no problem dictating to parents on a wide variety of other issues related to their children. Hawkins observed, as we watch other states, nations, and organizations reverse course on these experimental procedures, and they are experimental, on children, Laura Kelly will most surely find herself on the wrong side of history with her reckless veto of this common sense protection for Kansas minors. House Speaker Mike Johnson says he will push for aid to Israel and Ukraine this week. A judge denied Hunter Biden's motion to dismiss federal gun charges. And former President Trump and Mike Johnson are zeroed in on non-citizen voting. Credit card delinquencies hit an all-time high, so President Biden capped late fees. An embattled senior Fauci advisor used a private email account to discuss COVID-19 origins. And Dartmouth refused to bargain with a unionized basketball team. A Memphis officer, Joseph McKinney, was killed in a shootout with a man who had been released without bail after being caught with a machine gun in a stolen car. What could possibly have gone wrong? Well, on this day in history, 1492, Leonardo da Vinci is born in or near the Tuscan town of Vinci. 1865, President Abraham Lincoln dies 9 hours after being shot the night before by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theater in Washington. Andrew Johnson becomes the nation's 17th president. 1912, the British luxury liner RMS Titanic sinks in the North Atlantic off Newfoundland more than 2.5 hours after hitting an iceberg. 1,514 people die, while fewer than half as many survive. 1945, during World War II, British and Canadian troops liberate the Nazi concentration camp, Bergen-Belsen. 1947, Jackie Robinson's baseball, first black major league player, makes his official debut with the Brooklyn Dodgers on opening day in Ebbets Field. 1959, Cuban leader Fidel Castro arrives in Washington to begin a goodwill tour of the United States. Apparently, it didn't hold. 1974, members of the Symbionese Liberation Army hold up a branch of the Hibernia Bank in San Francisco. A member of the group is SLA kidnap victim Patricia Hearst. 1989, students in Beijing launch a series of pro-democracy protests. The demonstrations would culminate in a government crackdown at Tiananmen Square. I remember it well. 1998, Pol Pot, the notorious leader of the Khmer Rouge, dies at age 72, evading prosecution for the deaths of some 2 million Cambodians. But of course, he will face the ultimate judge. 2009, tens of thousands of protesters stage tea parties around the country to tap into the collective angst stirred up by a bad economy, government spending, and bailouts. 2013, two bombs made from pressure cookers explode at the Boston Marathon finish line, killing two women and an 8-year-old boy, injuring more than 260 others. On this day in history, 2014, Boko Haram terrorists kidnapped some 276 girls from the school in northeastern Nigeria. And finally, on this day in history, 2019, a massive fire engulfs Paris Notre Dame Cathedral as it is undergoing renovations, severely damaging one of the greatest architectural treasures of the Western world. Well, we are out of time. I want to thank James Blend for producing, Dave King for engineering, and thank you for making The Georgene Rice Show part of your day. Have a great night.
Thanks for listening to The Georgene Rice Show podcast. If you'd like more information on today's guests, please visit the show at kpdq.com. And like us on Facebook. And join us live every weekday at 4 for more critical thinking for critical times on 93.9 KPDQ.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.